Welcome to the Keys of the Kingdom with Brother Gregory of His Holy Church.
Well, welcome to Keys of the Kingdom. I'm Brother Gregory, and again, we're going to be talking about the Kingdom of God. We're going to be continuing after we began Mark 1 and told a little bit about Mark, and now we're getting into Mark 1, and we got through that chapter. And basically, you know, Mark is kind of an unknown writer. We don't really know who Mark is, and he wrote the shortest gospel. It's evidently compiled from previous, it's sometimes called the Q Gospels, which is not really a specific gospel. It's the questionable gospel. We don't know where it came from or who all wrote them. Mostly we just have the Q Gospels in the form of scraps of paper. No full Q Gospels exist. They kind of been lost. But somebody put the Gospel of Mark together, and it's attributed to Mark, but we don't know which Mark it was. It's basically written like the Q Gospels, with a little bit of introduction, a little bit of the storytelling, you know, to kind of move it along. So originally, the Greek philosophers would write just the sayings, their sayings. They would put these little brief sayings, and they would try to express principles in very short terms and words and everything, and that's how they spread the message of their philosophy. And, of course, it would be reasonable that, there were Israelites who did the same thing. But it's kind of uniquely Greek if you were to calculate all the different types of writing. And historians of Greek wrote a lot, and a lot of their philosophical writings have survived. And one of them is this narrative of sayings. And it's kind of what Mark seems to come from, with a little bit of, you know, setting the scenes, which makes it one of the shortest Gospels. It comes second in the Bible, but was probably written before Matthew. And it is very similar to Luke. John is much different in the layout and the format. It was written much later, trying to clear up some of the issues that a lot of people have. So anyway, we went through most of that, you know, the Gospel of Jesus. That's basically what it was, who was going to be called the Son of God, just as Caesar was called the Son of God, except for his method and means were different than those of Caesar, and therefore they will produce a different outcome. This is going to be a theme that constantly pops up in all the Gospels and in what we write about and talk about. But then it talks about, you know, what John is wearing. Why are they telling us what John is wearing? You know, when you first read in Matthew, it makes sense because we know that Matthew was writing to Jews in other parts of the world, including Parthia, and it would make sense to slip in the fact that John the Baptist was wearing garb that was usually exclusively limited to people of Parthia. And he was wearing a leather belt. It says skin here in Mark, but it's a leather belt as we read it in Matthew. And that it's a particular style of belt, a himian, which includes an extra strap under the loins, and that was common to the priests. There was another type of belt that was common to soldiers, and they would hang a sword on it, but he didn't necessarily wear a sword, so he had what appears to be the priestly garments of Parthia. And we know from, not from Mark, but from Matthew, that the genealogy, which is mentioned, there's no genealogy in Mark, but there was a genealogy written out by Matthew that Jesus and John the Baptist were both related to not only the royal line, but the priestly line of Parthia. And we know that many Christians gathered in Parthia later on, but Parthia began to go the way of Rome. And of course, you always have this in a civilization where some people are going one way and other people are going another way. And these are called, of course, in the Bible, we call it the way. Jesus preached the way. John the Baptist preached the way. And we talked about that in the morning show when we went through Mark 1. John the Baptist considered himself not worthy. But he baptized Jesus anyway. We didn't see the discussion about it as much in Mark, because it's more abbreviated. It's not necessarily abbreviated from a longer story. It just wasn't a longer story the way it was put down. You have to remember these books are being written out by hand on paper and then going to be carried somewhere else by hand. And so they try to condense things down, which is the nature of this Greek writing of sayings. You just put the sayings down, let everybody figure out the in-between. But when he came out of the water, and in this gospel, they talk about him going up for and dealing with temptations with somebody who is referred to as Satan, which really is a name that means adversary, and was going to be tempted by it. And they also talk about wild beasts. I don't know how many wild beasts you would have to contend with in Judea at that particular time. We know back in the days of David, there might be lions and bears and wolves and, you know, or at least some sort of canine predator. But there wasn't a lot of that at the time. So that representative of wild beasts may be meaning something else, means something more. And then, of course, it talks about angels, which are usually messengers, that somehow ministered unto him. So, I mean, it's very brief. It doesn't go into much detail. We can get some detail from the other Gospels, but it's all brief. Then, next thing, they just jump immediately. John goes to prison. Don't say anything why he goes to prison. They haven't really told us much about John's teachings. We know that Jesus comes out and now says, the time is fulfilled and the kingdom of God is at hand. Repent ye and believe the good news, the gospel. Anyway, he goes walking by the sea. He picks up, you know, Simon and Andrew and the Zebedee brothers, and it goes straight away. He called them from their father Zebedee, and they left and they're following Jesus. They go to Capernaum. They talk on the Sabbath in a synagogue, which is probably containing 10 families. Most synagogues didn't contain much more than 10 families. To contain more than 10 families, and of course, the men sat up close in the synagogue, and the women and young men sat farther back. The young men behind their fathers, and the women and daughters would be within earshot, but they were no part of the meeting that would often take place. Now, it might not have been that way in every synagogue. And it doesn't mean that the women didn't have a voice, but their voice was through their husbands. The same as the young men's voice was through their fathers. And I gave an example years ago in talking about this. There was a movie, A Place Called Alice. And I think it was A Place Called Alice, something like that. It's about a woman who was captured by the Japanese and marched all over, you know, Southeast Asia and Malaysia. And eventually the guard that was with them died. And, you know, it's a very dramatic story. It's not a bad movie. She is helped out by an Australian who helped save them from starving, took the rap for them stealing some chickens that they ate, and was literally crucified and nailed to a barn door and would not reveal who ate the chickens, which was the women. Eventually, the women were taken in by a village, and they worked in the village. They planted rice, and they just worked all day long, a lot of hard work, but they weren't being traipsed around. They didn't have a guard. They wore native outfits, and they were pretty tanned by this time, and so they got away with it. Nobody bothered them, and the village gave them protection. And they survived because the village that made sure that they had enough food and taught them what they needed to know, but everybody had to work. Many of the men had been stolen away by the Japanese, and so the women were having to work the fields on their own, and so it was very difficult times. When she finally was rescued and the war was over, she inherited a large sum of money, and she wanted to go back to that village. And they actually have video, what appears to be that village, with some of the men in that village, and they're supposedly having a meeting. You can see that it's not the same camera stock. It's stock that somebody went back and filmed in this village of a meeting that she wanted to have. She wanted to drill a well so they would have fresh water that wasn't going to be contaminated by cholera and diphtheria and some of the other diseases that would be in an open water source. And she said to the village leader, and this was a Kodak moment for me. I'm a little kid watching this, or pretty young. I don't know if I was a little kid, but it was many years ago, half a century ago probably now. It's an old movie. And she says, where do you want the well? And he says, I can't tell you. He says, well, you're the head of the village. He says, yeah, but I can't make decisions like this. That's not my job. His job was, and we talked about it this morning, to regulate the village, not to rule over it. Because the word regulate doesn't mean to rule over. It means to help organize. Still voluntarily organizing, but he was just like, if there was going to be a meeting, he would conduct the meeting, make sure everybody was accounted for and got to say their say. And so you see the video of them actually having a meeting in this village. It's not the regular film that was a part of the movie. It was clearly shot by a different camera in a different place. And you see all the old men sitting around in a circle with the head of the village organizing the meeting. And each of the old men get to say their say. We don't know what they're saying because they're speaking another language. And behind each of the men, I would see these young men that were similar to the old men that they were sitting behind, but were probably their sons. And behind them, you would see the women and young girls and young boys and children. And so the meeting was really the elders of the village, which was 10, 12 men were the elders of the village. And the sons behind them might be 30, 40 years old, maybe even 50 years old if their father was 70, they could be easily 50 years old, but they're not saying anything. They're just backing up their father. They're behind their father, and they're letting their father make a choice. And this is a patriarchy. Now, some people say, well, the young men get to have their say. Well, they will have their say. They will talk to their dad. But right now, they're giving the authority to their father. They're respecting their father's decisions. And what the decision is where do we put the well? And this is very important. You got a village. Everybody doesn't live right there in a little circle. So if you put it on the east end of the village, the people on the west end of the village have to walk twice as far to get the well. If you put it right in the center of the village, it's really to the advantage of the people in the center of the village. So there might be little nuances because, you know, the village isn't a straight line. There might be some people out here and some people out here. And so they're asking everybody's opinion, the heads of every family's opinion. And they all have to agree. And they know the guy that lives way out of the village, farther away from everybody else, he's going to have to walk farther. That's just going to be the way it is. You can't put it way out by him. But, you know, where can you put it where it's most convenient to the most people? So it might not be right in the center of the village because you might have somebody that's 300 yards from the center of the village. And if we put it 50 yards over here, he doesn't have as far to walk, and nobody else is increasingly burdened. So anyway, whatever the strategy is, they have to work this out. And somebody's going to have to concede, yeah, okay, that's reasonable. Let's put it there. Or there might be factors like if we put it too close to the river, when the river floods, the water could contaminate the well. If we put it over here, we know that there used to be a dump over here. Or maybe we know that there's some spring that has brackish water and they don't want to have that near their well. So they're going to put the... So they take all these things into consideration, make the decision. They all agree. The head elder of the village sees that they all agree. They're all there as witness that everybody agrees, and they come to a conclusion. Can you imagine they had to decide this with everybody? Everybody who was over 15 got to put their input in. The meeting would go for a really long time. And so, anyway, but this is how they work things out in a small village of 10, 12 families, which could be hundreds of people. Because, you know, a man might have 8 sons, and they all have families, and they all have children, and they all have wives. But only one is the elder of the family. This is what the word elder means in the Bible, most of the place you read it. This is the elder of the family. And so he gets to decide. And I always remember a story. We went to buy horses in Nevada. And we were going to buy Basker Curly horses, which is a kind of a Russian breed. But they had lived in Nevada for a long time on a Nevada ranch, which, you know, when the cowboys go out to round up cows or horses or whatever it is, they would take 5, 6, 7 horses with them. And they will ride every one that day. And they'll just, you know, take the saddle off one and put it on another and ride that. Because you can't ride You can't run the horse all day long. You just wear it out. You'll wear out its joints. I mean, they do it in these long distance rides, you know, these endurance horses. But that isn't what they do. They want a fresh horse because now they may find some cows that haven't run at all, and they want to round them up, and they're going to have to do a lot of running. And if the horse has already run all day, even a endurance horse, they don't run at full speed all day. So they have multiple horses, and they'll get on those horses and ride each one. Anyway, they rounded up a bunch of horses and brought them in, and they were deciding which ones they would sell and which ones they would keep for breeding. And some of them that they would sell would still be really good horses, but they didn't want them just to go to what they used to call chicken feed, which used to be doing in America. It would go to a meat processing plant, and they call it chicken feed. It didn't mean it was all going. Some of it may have gone to dog food. Who knows? It might be in Allie's beef stew, for all I know. But they would want to keep some of those horses, were still good, but they can't keep them all. And so anyway, that's what they were doing. They were rounding them up in these corrals, these old corrals with upright poles everywhere. And because they didn't have any lodge pole around, so it wasn't like lodge. It looked like a kind of a, you know, barricade that they were doing. And they were roping horses, and some of them, you know, one of them we had here for years and years. It died like at 32 or something. We did have one that was black. It turned white. It was a pretty good horse. We had several Basker Curlies on the place for quite a while. Some of them were just amazing, sure-footed animals. But anyway, they're getting ready to make the selection of which ones were going to be kept for breeding and which ones were going to sell. And they went in the house, and they got their father. And two of the sons, there was at least three sons there. I think there was like four all together, but one of them was a lot younger. But most of these young sons that were there were like in their 40s. They're all experienced cowboys. They all got an eye for horseflesh. But they went in and got their father, who was like 90 years old. And one son on each elbow helped their father walk out, mostly under his own power. But they were there so he didn't fall. And they brought him up to the edge of the corral where he could see through. And then they had some guys in the corrals running the horses by. And they would run by. And he would say, you know, this one was a keeper. I can't remember the exact word he used. And this one, we'll sell that. And this, keep that one, sell that one. And there's an old joke about inbreeding and crossbreeding, or what they call inbreeding and line breeding. Line breeding was a good thing. Inbreeding was a bad thing. But they're actually the same thing. But you get different results, supposedly. And there's maybe a little nuances that might be different. But they were letting him make that choice. He couldn't ride a horse all day long. He couldn't ride a team of horses all day. Although I know some 70, 80-year-old ranchers who could barely walk, but you put them at their foot in a stirrup and they'll be on that horse like John Wayne. And they'll ride that horse all day long. And not necessarily big guys, but tough guys. I was standing next to one just yesterday who was like that. I won't mention his name. But anyway, I'd known him for half a century. And but anyway, they can make those decisions without their father, but they let their father make those decisions. They trusted his judgment. Now, you know, when they let him back in the house, they might have cut out one that they decided they wanted to keep anyway, and their dad won't know, won't matter. But out of respect, they let him make the decision. This is important in families, that you have to respect your father and your mother. They may not be right, but you give them their lead. They got you where you're at, chances are. So you give them that. You make them a value in your life, and they will live longer, and your children will do the same for you. But the father and the mother have to be willing to turn over the reins of control. I can think of another scene in the old movie with Wendy Hiller. I know where I'm going. You can probably see these on YouTube now. I know where I'm going. And there's a scene in there where there's a Scottish wedding, or anniversary, a birthday, or whatever, anniversary they're celebrating. They've been married like 75 years. And they ask the father to say something. Everybody wants to hear what he has to say. This old gentleman, 90-some years old. And he goes to speak, and he just goes, no. He just lets it go. And then everybody goes back to dancing. But they all cheered him on. They gave him the opportunity. Because they all respect him. I mean, he has a huge family now because he has sons and grandsons and probably great-grandsons. But this is important in family and it's important in community. And it was extremely important in the Christian community because they wouldn't have survived without it. Well, today we see families breaking down. And we see them breaking down for a reason. And that's going to be part of the topic of the show, but we're going to come about it through a strange path. But anyway, so Jesus also had this ability to seemingly cast out demons, take people who were acting schizophrenic and, you know, I mentioned the word torn. Spirit was torn. And the body went into convulsions, but then the person was suddenly better. As if a spirit had been lifted from them. And of course, that's what they're telling us. Of course, a lot of people are going to say, oh, this is ridiculous. This is psychological. And they can believe that if they want. I have a tendency to believe, for lots of reasons that I'm not going to go into here, that it often is a spirit. Now, I will admit, there are psychological reasons for schizophrenia. And all schizophrenia doesn't necessarily involve external spirits. Schizophrenia is about division of a person. There's a division of the person, usually the result of trauma, where the person is not totally conscious of everything in their, that splitting of the person because of the trauma, where they actually develop one identity that can handle the memory of the trauma and another identity that doesn't ever want to talk about that trauma again. And you can heal the person so that schizophrenia comes together and that person is whole again, showing no signs of schizophrenia. You know, you go and talk to a lot of psychologists, I don't know what the number is at now, but years ago, you could go and talk to every psychologist and they say schizophrenia is incurable, they have to be on medication and they will always have to be on medication. Well, that's not true. As we know, that schizophrenia is pretty easy to diagnose by a professional. It's actually pretty easy by a non-professional if they get the training from somewhere. Because schizophrenia, of course, is a social construct. We made up that name. But it meets certain characteristics. And it is a pattern, psychological pattern, that we find in people. Where there's a division of personalities. Where there seems to be multiple personalities in one person. And they could hear voices. And we have an article and probably audios on the page about schizophrenia. But a bunch of schizophrenia's people who are schizophrenic are curing schizophrenia without drugs. That's one of the key elements, is no drugs. How are they doing it? What are they doing? And it's really very common sense oriented, and it's based on the fact that they released all kinds of schizophrenics from government hospitals, you know, public hospitals, where they were in institutions. And they released them, and they were supposed to stay on their meds, and they didn't. And they went back to look for these people, and they found many of them. Many of them were still schizophrenic. Some of them were still on their meds. Some were off their meds, wandering the streets. Some had died because they were homeless and on the streets, and exposure, and poor diet, and all kinds of reasons. Some of them ended up in jail because they got violent. All kinds of reasons. But some were absolutely cured with no sign of schizophrenia and adjusted into the world. And they were trying to figure out why, so they studied. And you know what it seems to me? The common characteristic, besides getting off of the drugs, which I'm not recommending, I'm just saying that they stopped taking their drugs. But the key element was somebody cared about them. Somebody loved them as they were. And actually patiently related, gave them a relationship, which gave them strength so that their personality could come back together and they could make peace with their opposing side. And if there was ever an evil spirit involved in their schizophrenia, it had no place to get into them because they had healed. There was no open psychological wound that was causing the reoccurrence of the schizophrenia, but they had healed. But Jesus could do it in a couple of minutes, so that's even better. Many of that healing processes took years and years. But Jesus raised the virtue. You remember when the woman touched his garment? He felt the virtue go out of him. And Jesus could project that virtue into other people. That takes a lot of love. Not just emotional love, but actually love in its spiritual form. And that's what we're seeing in Mark. And so, anyway, his fame spread. He healed Simon's mother instantly. Immediately is the word they use. Enon is another way they translate in the King James, the word immediately. But in the morning, Jesus went out by himself to a solitary place and was praying. Everybody went looking for him. They found him. And when they found him, he said, let's go to the next towns. Let's go to more towns. And he started doing it, and then he healed the leper. And, you know, when he healed the leper, he saith unto him, see thou say nothing to any man. That's the instruction. But go thy way, show thyself to the priests, and offer for thy cleansing those things which Moses commanded for a testimony unto them. So yes, this former leper, which a lot of times could be spotted because of their clothes, that a lot of times they had to make noise, they weren't supposed to come into town, nobody wanted to get near a leper because they knew there was some sort of contagion involved. Jesus told them not to tell anybody but the priests. And it says in 45, but he went out and began, and the word here in the King James is publish it much, to blaze abroad the matter, in so much that Jesus could not no more openly enter into a city, but was without in desert places, in empty places, desolate places. And they came to him from every quarter. So that people are now looking for him even out in the desolate places. So this leper did not do what he said. He was told to do certain things. I cannot imagine that there was not repercussions for the choice that that leper made. I'm not saying he was condemned or anything, but if Jesus tells you to do something, if the Holy Spirit tells you to do something, do it. Don't put it off. Don't make excuses. Get it done. And it's very important that you get it done. And do it according to the leading of the Holy Spirit. Don't procrastinate. That's what we all should be doing. But everybody doesn't do that. And so that word publish, it's Caruso. Do you know Caruso? What does that sound like? Isn't there an opera singer named Caruso? Caruso means preach. I mean, that's the way it's translated most often. It's preach, publish, proclaim. These are the words that it's translated into. But it's actually defined. I just use a concordance definition. A lot of times the concordances are based on what we think it meant to the people at that particular moment in time. It doesn't say necessarily preach in the definition. In the definition it says to be a herald, to officiate as a herald, to proclaim after the manner of a herald, always with the suggestion of formality, gravity, and an authority which much listened to and obeyed. Publish, proclaim openly something. Use of the public proclamation. So he was proclaiming, and of course they use the same word in reference to John the Baptist, who was proclaiming that the kingdom of God was at hand. It was within your reach. But this guy was told by Jesus, say nothing to any man, and he did the absolute opposite. And of course we don't see him seemingly again, or do we? Well, we'll find out later. But I just wanted to finish that up. This recording will go on with Mark 1 study, which I'm going to be still expanding. This show is somewhat complementary to the beginning of Mark, because we'll refer to these things throughout Mark, because I know what Mark is going to be telling you. And there's a disease of anger and resentment that is alive and well in the world today. And we need to do something about it. And that disease is wantonness. That disease is socialism. Socialism is you want benefits and you want them at the expense of somebody else, and you're willing to apply force. Now, a socialist is going to say, and you'll see this because I have quotes from many, many socialists that we're going to go over today. There was a post on Facebook by somebody who said, if you are sending your kids to public school today, you are sending your kids to a type of religious school. It's an irreligious school. That's what he says. I'm just quoting. I think he saw the post somewhere else and he put it up. It's an irreligious school. It's an anti-religious school. But it's like a religion in the sense that they have gods of their own making, and they worship those gods. And certainly that is the case. But what does he mean? You know, because we could be very confused about what the individual means and what he's trying to say and what he's trying to share with us. And we should take the time, if we think he's wrong, if we think he is misleading people or been misled himself to think things that are simply not true, wouldn't a good person want to find out exactly what you mean and help him out with his confusion? Wouldn't that be what a good person would want to do? Well, I would think so. But evidently other people think they ought to do something different. Well, anyway, I responded to it. I see it come in. I know who the guy is. Sort of know who the guy is. I was kind of surprised. I wanted to know. When I posted to it, all kinds of people were very upset with my post. A lot of people were upset with his post. And I thought, like, where do all these people come from? Because, I mean, like, he had, like, 32 likes and 128 people who made, you know, the laughing face, the mocking face. We're just mocking because it's so stupid what you said. You're so ignorant. You're so foolish. And so they put this little mocking face up. And there were all kinds of comments that were derogatory, used bad language, were rude, and vile even at some points. But then I made my little post. And my little post simply said, it is not irreligious. So I'm criticizing him. Or criticizing the statement. Again, I don't think it was his original statement. It is not irreligious. It is the typical pagan religion based on force and socialism. Just not pure religion. And then I put in the link to our article on pure religion at Preparing You. And I make these kind of comments all the time. And I don't disagree with what it sounded like he was trying to say, but irreligious, or even, he says, anti-religious, they're not anti-religious. Because, I mean, in this very next statement, he's even saying, like a religion, so it is religious. Religion, again, and we talked about it this morning, is how you take care of the needy of society. That's what religion is. I just posted a video on Facebook that was a part of an interview. The guy clipped it up, so I'm just like machine gunning people with the truth. I told him that with the stuff that I was throwing out, and he asked a few questions and everything in the whole video, that the stuff I was throwing out was like skipping rocks across a pond. The rock hits the pond and makes waves. It hits a pond in another place and makes waves. It hits a pond in another place and it makes waves. And eventually all those waves go out and they start crisscrossing over each other. And the waveform runs into the other waveform. And there's ripples on the water. And I was throwing out chunks like that, like skipping rocks across a still pond. And I'm going to stir up people. He was worried I was going to upset the atheists. I said, probably going to upset the Christians more than the atheists. What I've done now also, I might as well let you know, is that I have a page on socialism at Preparing You, and I also have a page on a socialist at Preparing You. And it wasn't a very long page, the socialist page, but and I hadn't looked at it for years and years. I've added dozens of links to it already on the page, links to other articles. But down at the bottom I have socialist versus kingdom. I may change that to socialist versus the way. Or maybe socialist versus righteousness. That would be a good title. But right now it says socialist versus kingdom. So anyway, I copied and pasted lots of the comments that came out from my comment, and where the people actually addressed me and responded to me. And I think that it's kind of an interesting study in the psychology of socialists. And the reason I bring it up here is because it happened this week, and this is the week we started Mark. But also, in the Gospel of Mark, in that chapter 1, the leper, when he comes to Jesus, he beseeches, requests from Jesus to be healed. He kneels down in front of Jesus to be healed. And I have never heard anybody point out the hypocrisy, maybe, the dichotomy of what we're seeing take place in this story. But he kneels down before Jesus and beseeches him as a master to heal him. And Jesus has compassion upon him. It's not like he owes him healing, but his compassion caused him to reach out and touch a leper. And he was instantly healed. The virtue went out of him and healed that man because he had approached him humbly. But then he instructed him, don't tell anybody. But then he went out and told everybody and made Christ's ministry more difficult. Christ was probably okay with it because Christ will turn it to good. But why is that even happening? Something wrong. You say you submit to the Lord, but you don't do what he tells you. Not a good thing. Not a good plan of action. Of course, now a lot of the people that are going to respond to this don't even believe that there's a God. But they don't understand the statements that were made in that original statement. It says, like a religion in the sense that they have gods of their own making and they worship those gods. So what gods are they talking about? Well, nobody was asking that question. No, none of the trolls said, what do you mean gods of their own making? What, who are these gods of their own making? Nobody asked the question. They just assumed he was wrong and said bad things about him. Said, you know, derogatory things and accusations and mocking phrases. I won't even get into all the rude and mocking phrases that I saw come on this stream of trolls coming out. And this is what I saw a lot on Twitter, when I used to be on Twitter. I'm now on not Twitter, but X. And I will be posting, try to be posting more to that. We talked to the other ministers about doing more there. The first person that I responded to was Rebecca Coran Meany. And I put their names right here. And I put the post up there. I don't know if you can find it, but if you find my Facebook, you can probably go back and find it. It's all there somewhere. I'm sure the NSA has a copy. So anyway, somebody was talking about you go get on an airplane. They say, well, we'd like to take a picture for biometric purposes. And they said, well, I don't want to do that. And they said, well, you have to. Well, you don't have to, evidently. It's voluntary. And they're not telling you the truth. And they said, we delete the picture within seconds after we use it. We're just testing the equipment, you know, et cetera, et cetera. Well, yeah, they delete it in seconds because in less than a second, they send it on to the government. And it goes into a database for at least 75 years. And assumingly, you'll all be dead in 75 years. And maybe many of you will be dead long before that. But yeah, so you don't have to do that. But anyway, I thought it was funny that they said, well, we delete it in seconds. What they don't tell you is just after we send it on to the government. So, but technically, you don't have to submit to the biometrics. You just gave your ID and everything. I'm sure my picture's already, I've told funny stories about that. My picture's all over the NSA. So, they're not as clever as they think they are. The God I work for is really clever. I'm not really clever. I'm pretty naive at times. But anyway, let's hear what Rebecca had to say. Rebecca says, Gregory Williams, sounds like you don't know what communism / socialism is, but okay. So somehow or other, she thinks I was talking originally about communism and socialism, which of course I was not. I didn't say anything about communism, never even mentioned it until she brought it up. And then I gave her my answer to what socialism and communism is. Well, like I said, there were other... My reply was, Rebecca Curran Meany, socialism is an economic and political system which redistributes the production of wealth of others by force. It is popular with slothful people who have no moral restriction when it comes to coveting what others produce and are fine with instituting force to get it. Communism is the same, but on steroids. And I gave her a link to communism. Comments being made, somebody else, Jacob Cross addressed Rebecca. What does any of this have to do with workers owning the means of production? And so I think Jacob Cross might be another, a socialist. And he thinks that workers owning the means of production is what socialism is, because that's what they tell you. But it isn't. Socialism is not the worker owning the means of production. It's the collective owning the means of production. So the collective owns the worker. the collective can take away from a worker what he has produced and redistribute it. And of course, because socialism is a political and economic system, the political powers of socialism get the power to take away from the worker what he has produced and redistribute it according to the way they see fit. Now, people like to think, well, we're going to create democratic socialism, and if they're unjust to us, we will take away from them. You see, we will take the power away from them because it's democratic socialism. Problem is that once you go socialism, you're going to find that the government gets more power and the people get less power. Occasionally, that rolls back and forth a little bit, like waveforms, but the reality is you're going to end up with less and less power. Then I see Michael J. Case says, Gregory, I doubt if you could spot a socialist if one was up your A-something-some-S knitting a sweater. This guy's not interested in knowing what I'm talking about. He's not even really interested in knowing what the conversation is about. He's not trying to communicate. He's just trying to posture and make resort to foul language in order to do it. So I just said, Michael J. Case, socialists are generally too lazy to knit a sweater. They would rather take someone else's sweater. And then I put one of my little happy faces there with my shepherd's hat on. So anyway, it wasn't an interesting conversation. It wasn't interested in finding out what I think or what I'm actually saying. And I know I was cryptic at the beginning, but why isn't he interested? Because he doesn't care about anybody else. He wants to hate somebody. And so they have this word, capitalism, which none of them understand what a capitalist is. See, capitalism is when the worker gets to own the means of production. That's what capital. That is actually what capitalism is, because he's the means of production. Capitalism means you get to own yourself, and everything you produce or earn with your labor is yours, 100% yours. Doesn't belong to the collective. It doesn't belong to me. It belongs to you. I don't have any right to take away what you produce. You plant strawberries in your yard and you grow a bunch of strawberries. I don't have a right to those strawberries. I could come up and say, could I have some of your strawberries? And you could give me some. You could say, well, I actually saw you had a bunch of asparagus. Do you have any left over? Because I'd like some asparagus. I don't have any asparagus. And I could say, well, I don't have any asparagus left because the season's already passed. But I can give you the seeds when they come. And if you can give me some strawberries, we'll trade. I can do that. Under socialism, if you make that trade, the government gets a share. They're going to get a share. They're going to get some of your strawberries, and they're going to get some of my asparagus. Socialism is not when the worker owns the means of production. It's when the majority of workers own the other workers. That's what socialism is. And you don't have any private property. Socialism is against private property. And one of the most important properties you have is your right to labor. And socialism doesn't believe you have a right to 100% of your labor. You know, as soon as they started doing income tax after you got a Social Security number, I mean, there was income tax on corporations, but corporations don't have a right to their profits because they're entities of the state. They're children of the state. Most corporations. When you incorporate under the state, you're an entity of the state, and if you make a profit, they can tax that profit. Profit. That's corporate excise tax. And even later on, taxes that we see on fiduciaries of corporations, like with the 16th Amendment. The fiduciaries of corporations are making, you know, like $1 million. Like the president of International Harvester. He got to be the president and ran the corporation into the ground. Really, just super bad management. Paid himself $1 million bonus for doing it. And eventually they put somebody else in charge, but it was too late. Because he had, well, between him and the unions, they totally bankrupt International Harvester, and it just had to sell itself out to somebody else. And at a terrible loss. People lost a lot of money. Because they didn't understand the kingdom, for one thing. Certainly the union didn't. But certainly the corporate president didn't. Certainly the board of directors didn't. But long before that, the government that allowed corporations to have a status above that of a human, they didn't understand the kingdom. Because a corporation, you go read our article on Golem, G-O-L-E-M, and you'll find out. The kingdom is so different. These people have no idea what they're complaining about. And they don't want to know. And we see this from their responses. I got another response from Kyle Friday. Gregory Williams, imagine the sheer luck it took to make it this long, being this dumb. So that was his response to my response. He doesn't know what I mean by the things that I say. He didn't read the article. Doesn't want to read the article. He assumes he already knows. This is like the leper coming up to Jesus and says, "You have the power to heal me. Heal me, bastard." You know, because a lot of people thought Jesus was an illegitimate child. What the message of Christ was. No, we don't understand it. It's just all made up. Because they know it already. Well, they're not going to get very far in the kingdom. Because they don't come with a humble heart. They come with arrogance. So I replied, you know, Kyle Friday, do you or does your group of 8 members, he has 8 people who are following him. You know, I got more than 8 people in my family. But he has 8 members following him. Have anything articulate or intelligent or even just interesting to add to the topic or any topic of value? We're going to get into another guy, which is Tom Wilson. And Tom Wilson was actually a little bit articulate. Eventually, he didn't start out that way. Here's his first response. Gregory Williams, absolutely ratioed on your own comment in a safe space. Well, I don't know what that's all about, but I had to look up ratioed. Ratioed meant that I was getting more of these guffaw laughing faces, which people think somehow is a comment. It doesn't mean anything. You don't know what they're laughing at. What are they disagreeing with? What's their actual position? They have no interest in communicating. And that's a key element that we're dealing with here. Anyway, my response to Tom Wilson, and Tom Wilson appears many times in this. I said, the truth is the only real safe space. I was curious why there are so many socialists on Brother Billy's group, which is the guy who made the original post. Most of the reactions explain nothing about their position, so I cannot help them. And then Tom comes back. Gregory Williams, the truth is often not a safe space. The actual truth, that is. We are here because this push has been shared to another group, and it's being laughed over thoroughly. I tried to find out what the group was, and nobody really shows me what the group is. But it's evident. There were a couple of posts where people pointed you to another group that was very socialist, even communist. But that's not necessarily where these all were coming from. But Tom Wilson, I said, I guess safe is a relative term. Better to be attacked for the truth than secure in a lie. So, to me, even if you get crucified, even if you get attacked, if you're attacked because you're standing up for truth, that's okay. You may get bruised. You may get injured. You may even get beat up. You may even get killed. You may even get crucified. But you're better off standing up for the truth than shutting up and settling for the lie. So I'm kind of a guy who speaks up. But I went on to say, so what is your complaint about my post other than your concern about my safety and the ignorant laughter of fools? Because that's what we're dealing with. Link to my article on fools so you know what a fool is. And you know, it's an appropriate term. If we look at when Saul imposed a sacrifice on the people, he taxed the people in order to support the military because they were afraid that the Philistines were going to attack. And so he forced an offering on the people, which is what socialism is all about. I didn't go on and explain this to him. He didn't ask. But if you go read the article, you'll see that they're all laughing because they're all socialists. But to be a socialist is to think that it's okay to force the sacrifices of your neighbor. Which, of course, means your neighbor is not going to come to your aid. As a matter of fact, you're instituting the rule of force and violence to take away from your neighbor because you're content with living at the expense of your neighbor and depending upon the property of your neighbor for your livelihood. Because you're socialist. And socialists always take away from the most productive to give to the least productive. Which is why a lot of very unproductive people who aren't knitting sweaters are socialists. Because they're drawn like a moth to the flame. You know, are butterflies drawn to flames? No, they sleep at night. That's another thing, is all the posts from the socialists, very few of them came in the morning. And I noticed Tom Wilson's often came in the morning. But a lot of these others, they came in late in the day. And I have to go along with Jordan Peterson, who said that if you want to have a talk and you don't want all the socialists to come and harass you at the university when you have your talk, schedule it for the morning. They won't be up. I don't know if that's true, but I thought that could be true. That was very interesting. Very interesting observation. But Tom Wilson responded, exactly. So is it exactly what I said? Of course, see, he still believes that he believes the truth and that I'm not speaking the truth. So it's hard for him to figure out exactly. He says, I don't know what you have, you impression I care about your safety. And I just copied and pasted it, so that's the way he wrote it. I think he says, what he's trying to say is, I don't know why you think I care about your safety. I was being sarcastic, but anyway, I explained that. And I don't have an issue with the laughter. I'm actually doing a bit of it myself. We have pages where this kind of backwards think makes funny content. I should have asked him, where are those pages? But I actually did look at one of the pages that somebody was posting and look at it, and they were bad-mouthing Thomas Sowell as some sort of ignorant person. I don't know. He's 80-some years old and still writing deeply complex, well-researched books. So, and these other guys are putting laughter memes on Facebook and thinking that they're contributing to society. And I responded to Tom Wilson. I will admit, I was being a bit sarcastic. I noticed you avoided answering my question about what is your complaint about my post. I'm saving these posts to use on a radio broadcast. I thought I'd let it know. I was hoping some of the laughing mockers would come up with a coherent comment or just a substantive statement. But I wasn't getting any. I'm not burdening you with half, not even probably 20% of the nonsense that was posted. Just absolute dribble, or drivel, as some would say. But anyway, Craig Thompson then said, Gregory, ah yes, you failed history, didn't you? Forget how Christians threatened a bunch of pagans with death or torture if they didn't convert, did you? Forget how you all stole a bunch of pagan holidays and supplanted Jesus over them, did you? Forget that y'all aren't the only people of religion. I'll put another link here to religion so people can find out what religion really is, because this guy doesn't know what religion is. He hasn't got a clue. He's basing it on the definition that the socialists, bankers that people call capitalists, the Federal Reserve was started by a bunch of bankers who were also socialists and communists. That's just a matter of record. It's not a secret. You can go and read their memoirs. You can go read their daily diary, and they're extremely communistic and socialistic, and they're bankers. And people would say, well, they're capitalists. No, they're socialists. They want you to hate capitalism because capitalism would give you back the means of production. But it'd have to be moral capitalism because, of course, as I say many times, socialism is a political and economic system. Capitalism is just an economic system. It's not a political system. It doesn't require a political system. For it to be successful, like with any society, it requires morality. And morality is conforming to the laws of nature and nature's God, which is another way of saying divine will. But anyway, I responded to Craig Thomas. Those were not real Christians. Those were Constantinian Christians. But modern Christians, most modern Christians, do what early Christians were murdered for not doing. Amazing? Early Christians were being persecuted, often as atheists, for not joining up with the social welfare system of FDR. Oh, excuse me. I didn't mean FDR. I'm being sarcastic here. The social welfare system of Caesar. Because Caesar was the son of God. Jesus was the son of God. But Caesar's son of God operated by force and fear, covetous practices that ended up where the people were under fealty. But Christ operated by the perfect law of liberty through free will offerings and what we would call the Corban of Christ. And so, if you operate according to the Corban of Christ, you're going to get different results. It's a different means and method. See, there's that word again. I told you I'd bring that back in. And there's a reason why. And we actually went over that a little bit briefly. I touched on it with one of the definitions that we looked at in Mark 1. That early Christians were murdered for not doing. And what was that? Well, they wouldn't sign up for the social welfare, for the tables of Caesar and his pagan temples. I mean, the word pagan was almost invented by Christians. It would not have survived except for Christian writings, where they referred to people who had these temples that did not operate by faith, hope, and charity, but force, fear, and fealty, you know, where you became subject. The ones that did that, that was the different, it's the Christian conflict. Learn the whole truth of history. But, no, he's not going to like that, probably, but that's okay. I got another one, Kokichi Oma, which I actually don't think is their real name. It could be, but I'm suspecting. I didn't read up a great deal about it. I go to these people's pages and try to figure out where they're coming from, because you can't tell a lot of times from their posts, because they're not very articulate, they're not very explanatory, and they're not really interested in communicating. They're posting like they did something. I didn't do anything to make the world greater, but I certainly told somebody on Facebook what I thought, which is kind of why you can't get much good out of Twitter. There aren't real solutions on Twitter. It could be if you get the right group and you're communicating and then you use it as an outreach, we could do something with Twitter. But, what is it? X-Space. I guess this guy got to start calling it X-Space. Kokichi Oma says, Gregory Williams and current modern-day Christianity in America isn't somehow based on force and fascism? So that's a question. So they think Christianity is based on force and fascism. I'll take the pagan socialist one than you. That seems to be a direct quote, so that's the way they worded it. And I put in a link to our article on paganism so that people can find out a little bit more. You know, they use these terms. They really don't know how these terms came about, the history of the terms, what they meant, etc. But I responded to Kochi Oma, like I just explained to Craig Thompson, I do not advocate what you call modern Christians. Because I do not think many of the modern ones are real Christians. Those are Constantinian Christians. So anyway, this is an important distinction, and this is why I've written more and more. I really have a lot more I could add to our pages on Constantine and the bishops that came out of the Constantinian church, because there was a whole new set of bishops that were created. And you read our article on Ambrose, it's a great example. You know, Ambrose was not a Christian, didn't know anything about Christianity, but everybody in Milan had to become a Christian, get baptized and become a Christian. They didn't have to repent and get baptized. They just had to become a Christian. They all became Christians and then went to the guy who was running the welfare system for Rome through the temples of Rome, and they elected him to be the bishop of all of Rome, and that's not how Christians were organized. Christians were organized in the tens, hundreds, and thousands. You were only a bishop if you were a minister to other ministers. That's how you got to be a bishop. And although we didn't use the term archbishop hardly at all, that was a term that came up in the Constantinian church. Whatever be a bishop of bishops would be the, as you go up through the tens, hundreds, and thousands. And this was very important in the operation of the daily administration, and which is why in Acts we see them picking seven guys. Who are these seven guys? Are they bishops? What is their role? What is their function? See, most people don't know that. And Kochi Oma does not know that. Like I just explained to Craig, I do not advocate the modern Christian because I do not think many of the modern ones are real Christians. Those are Constantinian Christians. And so I'm defining terms. This is going to be very important as I go on. So, but these people are not logical. They don't understand like the three basic rules of logic, which I have a link to, so that people can find out what are the three basic rules of logic. Most modern Christians do what the early Christians were murdered for not doing, which was eating at the table, joining up with the table of the government, the men who exercise authority, which is what socialists want. They want more benefits through the government, a socialist government. But they were murdered for this, which is what I just said to the other guy when it comes to Christian conflict. And almost none of them do what the early Christians actually did, which was have a daily ministration of pure religion, where they took care of the needy of their society through charity alone, only through charity, not through men who exercise authority. As soon as you start using men who exercise authority to take care of your widows, your orphans, your ill, your sick people, your injured people, anybody, you're not practicing pure religion. Your religion is now spotted. And you should immediately put a knife to your throat and decrease your dependence upon that system. And turn around your thinking, repenting, and start seeking the kingdom of God. What the people of Milan did, they turned their thinking around a little bit because they knew that they were going to have to contribute. But right away, Constantine gave this new church that he was creating millions upon millions of dollars in silver and land and buildings and to jumpstart them, but they were now going to have to support the system through free will offerings. He was going to have to do it again and again. Where was he getting that money from? Murdering other people. Invading towns. Killing whole cities. Murdering everybody in the city. Stealing every piece of gold, every piece of thing that they had, and then selling their property as if it was his own. This is Constantine was doing that. I mean, the first thing that Ambrose did was meet in front of the Senate and say, I want you to persecute everybody who isn't a Christian like I am. Well, how did he get to be a Christian? Well, he said right out when they wanted to elect him, they found him in a brothel, they wanted to elect him as the bishop. He wasn't married, was the husband of one wife, and none of that. He'd been working for Caesar for years. He had to ask permission from Caesar, can I leave my post to go learn what Christianity is about, because I don't know anything about Christianity, and then I'll come back and I will. Well, he went and learned something. I don't know what he learned, but the first thing he wanted to do is get sent to persecute anybody who wasn't going to practice the Christianity as he learned it. Well, that ain't Christ. So you want to know where the Crusades came from? Well, that's another hole, because somebody brings up the Crusades. Early Christians did not use force in fascism. I mean, they didn't use force at all. And then, of course, I put a link in here to fascism because people use that term all the time. As a matter of fact, I'm going to do an experiment here. Okay, I'm going to play this and see if you guys can hear it. I haven't ever done this before.
In 1943, the following directive was issued from party headquarters to all communists in the United States. It read, when certain obstructionists become too irritating, label them after suitable buildups as fascist, or Nazi, or anti-Semitic, and use the prestige of anti-fascist and tolerance organizations to discredit them. In the public mind, constantly associate those who oppose us with those names which already have a bad smell. The association will, after enough repetition, become fact in the public mind.
I know he's not fascist, but it's more just of getting the community together to just go against.
A lot of people said he's not actually fascist, so then why call him a fascist?
No, I don't know the exact definition of a fascist, so I don't know the answer as a fascist.
Okay, so the guy speaking there was speaking back in the 50s. I actually know that guy. He's still around. He lives in Oregon. His brother lives in Oregon. I know his brother. We were both going to be called into court at the same time. So we have that much in common, which I told that story. They wouldn't subpoena me, but I showed up anyway. I heard that they were trying to. But anyway, they wouldn't call on me, and that was that bizarre situation where the judge was, nobody could figure out, what is the judge doing? Why is he talking to that guy? It was funny. But I was learning a lot through that. But anyway, I know that guy, and there was two of them. The old one, the girl admits, and that was at a rally, and there was a lot of confusion and noise in the background. But she says they're all calling, I assume, Trump or somebody a fascist, somebody they don't like. And they says, so if you know he's not a fascist, why are you calling him a fascist? Well, that's the instructions from the Communist Party. Of course, she doesn't know that. That to just throw these blanket labels on. We saw the media doing that with Trump all the time. I mean, even Stossel does it with Trump all the time. Trump's a terrible exaggerator. He isn't really all that mean. He's blunt. He's a New Yorker. He's actually extremely kind. I don't hear of hardly any situation where he pinched the small guy, the little guy, out of their money. As a matter of fact, there are countless stories and real witnesses. I mean, my next-door neighbor has relatives that work in Trump's house. And I say, he knows everybody. He knows all the cooks. He knows the gardeners. He knows them by their name. He knows their families. He's actually an extremely generous guy. He's an egomaniac. I don't know. I know he's not your salvation, but he isn't what the media has portrayed him as. And, of course, that's the plan. But, of course, Biden isn't what the media portrays him as either. At least Stossel was admitting they both lie. But, you know, Stossel trying to come up with lies. He even lies about the number of people at his inauguration. Well, he said, I think it's one of the biggest inaugurations. Well, how many inaugurations has he been to? And there was a lot of people there. And we know, we have video of the protesters blocking people who wanted to go to the inauguration. I mean, hundreds of people. We have videos of the radical left blocking people who wanted to go to the inauguration of Trump. Had they all been let in, it may have been one of the biggest. It certainly was big anyway. It wasn't tiny. He's an exaggerator. It's not like he lied. Very few lies coming out of Trump compared to Biden, compared to a lot of, I mean, Pelosi, Schumer, those guys. I mean, you're going to complain about Trump and his exaggerations? You know, but Trump, you know, made lots of mistakes. But he bombed less people, got in less wars. The economy did turn around. It didn't turn around with anybody else. But again, Trump is not your salvation. Christ is your salvation. So anyway, I wanted to do that one experiment, and that's why I was putting in these definitions of fascism, is because of the fact that nobody knows what it means to be a fascist. And, of course, I put links where the force is. I never know who all is going to come to these pages to learn the whole truth of history. But anyway, Kochi Oma came back with their response. Not really, but whatever. You know, such intellectual, in-depth thinking from these people. They don't want to think. They're not really interested in thinking. So I responded, not really? Not really what? Try to stay on one topic if you want real answers. Use nouns and adjectives and the rules of logic. And so Kochi Oma writes back, they literally did that. You, SH something T, leaves out the Crusades. And so I again say the Crusades were after the formation of the Church of Constantine. As a matter of fact, it was a long time after, like 700 years, 800 years, 900 years after the formation of the Church of Constantine, which is not Christianity. Can you imagine Christ forming the Crusades to go kill Muslims? The reality is a lot of people went there to help defend certain areas because there were Muslims that were overrunning certain villages and cities. Jerusalem was almost always predominantly Jewish. You go back a long ways and it was almost predominantly Jewish. But then what does that mean? What kind of Jew? What are we talking about? And so, you know, you have to look at that. But what Oma is doing is strawmanning. It wants to believe that everything that anybody who says they're a Christian does defames all of Christianity. Christianity has the doctrines of Christ. If Christ didn't preach the Crusades, then that's not a Christian. If a Christian is defined as a follower of Christ. But we have the same thing with the Jews. You got Hasidic Jews, you got Zionist Jews, you got Jews that just, you know, they wear Hanukkah on Sabbath. You got Jews that keep almost none of the rules, but, you know, they might, you know, have Hanukkah or a few of the Jewish holidays. They may have a doctor circumcise their kid. They don't eat kosher, you know, but they still call themselves Jews. So, you know, it's really dangerous to use these terms like Jews and then lump millions of people into one group. We have to use adjectives and nouns. We have to modify the nouns we're using, explain who we're talking about. Them that say they are Jews and are not Jews. Now, if we define a Jew as a follower of Moses, well, that really probably cuts down on most of the people who say they're Jews. Because most of the people that I run across, there may be a lot that I don't run across. I've done no worldwide survey. But most of them I run across aren't doing what Moses said. Because Moses said that all your offerings to take care of the needy of your society, from the altars of Jehovah Nissi on, and even before, have to be free will offerings. Well, all the welfare in the modern Zionist state we call Israel, all that welfare is not free will offerings. They're forced offerings through socialism. And, they were about ready to bankrupt the whole country, and one guy calls himself Jewish, calls himself the leader, roll back their social security system, their social welfare system, and made it leaner, cut it back, and things got better right away. He only rolled it back. Can you imagine if they actually started following Moses in Israel? Actually started doing what Moses said, which is why we write articles on the red heifer. They want to kill a red heifer and they think they're going back to the daily ministration. No. You're only going back to the daily ministration when you start taking care of your needy through faith, hope, and charity. Through the Corban of Moses. If you're going to keep playing religion and taking care of the needy of your society through the Corban of the Pharisees and Herod, you're not following Moses, you're following Herod. It's that simple. But if people don't do any studying, they're not going to be very intelligent. So I applied to Oma an intelligent argument to give about what? Because that's what she says. She says, you have no intelligent arguments to give. About what? About force? You didn't read the argument in the essay that I shared about the Crusades. You probably won't read it either. The first rule of logic is to identify. There is a vast difference between the modern church and the early church. They're not doing the same things. And that's why we have articles up so you can find out what was the early church doing, what is the modern church doing. And then we have articles on what the Pharisees were doing, what the Sadducees were doing, what the Essenes were doing, and find out, we're identifying what everybody is doing. And then you get to decide, am I going to do what Christ said, which is what Moses said, what Moses really said, not what the Pharisees said Moses was saying. They got it wrong. We know that. Christ told us. So we need to turn around our thinking. This is how do you know what to repent of? So anyway, Oma just says, doesn't matter. Well, it will matter. And when it does matter, Oma's going to be weeping and gnashing of teeth. I hope she wakes up. Now, Tori D. Betts Van Kirk, she said Jesus was not a capitalist. She didn't like it, the fact that I said that Jesus was a capitalist. Of course, Jesus was a capitalist. He said to sell everything you own and give it to the needy. He said rich people cannot get into heaven. Well, of course, he didn't say anything like that whatsoever to the general public. And I explained, Jesus was clearly a capitalist. And, of course, she's not going to like that, but I'm saying it. But now, is she going to say, why does he keep insisting upon that? Well, that will be up to her to ask the question and try to find out. The Bible teaches capitalism beginning to end and condemns socialism and one purse and the dainties of rulers, which is what socialism is, because it doesn't matter whether it's the majority of socialists who vote that everybody gets a share of the guys who work the hardest, the guys who are the most talented. They have to support the other guys. They're going to rely on force to get that job done. That's just the way they are. That is the name of it. That's why it's a political system, because they use political leaders to force the contributions and redistribute wealth. And if you do that, you will destroy society. You will degenerate society. And I'm not the only one who says it. All kinds of people say it. The Bible teaches capitalism from the beginning to the end. You get dominion. You're to dress it and keep it. Nobody else is to covet what you produce. What you produce is yours. When you stray for that, like you have to go eat at the table of Pharaoh, and now he gets 20% of your labor, that's bondage. And you're never to go back to the bondage of Egypt again. You're never to go back to the socialism of Egypt again, where a portion of your labor can be taken away by other people and redistributed amongst who they think is the needy of society. Like the turtle dove goddess of Sumer. Like Nimrod. Like Pharaoh. Like Cain. Like Sodom, the city-state of Sodom. Because that weakens the poor. We know that not just because Christianity says, because the pagans said so. Pagans like Polybius. Pagans like Plutarch. Greatest destroyers of liberty are the givers of gifts, gratuities, and benefits. Who ruined Rome was he who spread amongst them those dainties, those benefits. Well, or Proverbs says it too, but the Bible is a philosophy book more than it is a book about religion, as we use the word religions today. It is about religion because it's about government, and government is about religion because faith and allegiance are the same thing. Allegiance is where you swear faith, and the faith of Christ is where You give faith. You choose to be faithful to the way of Christ, which is the way of charity. The way of force, that's going to end up requiring allegiance. And it's going to make you subject to rulers, tyrants, despots, kings. That's what the year of Jubilee was about. And I tell Betts, which I think is a woman, Tori Betts. Yeah, I remember that. But I know you think you know what you're talking about, but you're wrong. Read the article. And this one too, All Things Common. So I have an article, All Things Common. I put the link down there so that she can find it. And read that article, and you'll know what and who Jesus was talking to him when he said, sell all you have. He didn't say that to everybody. He's only saying that to his ministers. Now that's a teaching that your modern ministers are not going to like. They like their estates and their mansions and their pensions and all this stuff. They like the benefits of the new exit. Of course, that's why they're the harlot. That's why they ride the beast. They depend upon the beast providing for them Social Security, Social Welfare, Medicare, Medicaid. They depend on all that stuff because they're not really the faithful. Well, how are the unfaithful going to teach you to be the faithful? They're not. So Christ said, you guys are going to have more faith, like the Levites. See, Moses said the Levites don't have any inheritance in the land. Their inheritance is the fact that they're the Levites. They're the ministers you're going to depend upon. Now, you get to pick the Levite of your choice. And you get to pick how much you want to give. And they're supposed to rush and say, pay in full, whatever you give. But they also control the social welfare. If they know you've been slothful and not giving and drinking up all the extra money and squandering on vacations and toys and wives and what have you, or husbands, whatever, you're toying with what, and you're not sharing with the poor, don't expect a big portion when you are in need. They may take care of you. They may not. I got a lot of great stories about that, but we'll go on. Tori Betts also wrote, not true. Christians is a not true Scotsman fallacy. She said, not true Scotsman fallacy. And then she says a bad word, a BS with a lot more letters. They were Christians. No, they were not. So she also wrote, I'm not reading a website of opinions. Prove the biblical text that Jesus was pro-capitalism. Well, I replied, that is not what the website does. It's not just opinion. You would know if you read it, but she didn't want to read it, so I gave her another happy face. She did come back with, I did, and it has no proof, just claims. So if you are really a real Christian, you should be able to pull up scripture to back your claims. Well, she says there's no proof. Anybody can go to the web pages I shared with her, and you can see hundreds of footnotes, all kinds of quotes from the Bible, showing you the Greek, showing you the Hebrew. So whatever page she read, it wasn't my page. So I don't know if she sounds like a liar, but she says you're not a real Christian, just a faker, like the rest of you, rest who ignore Jesus. Well, I don't ignore Jesus, so I don't know where she gets that. But you can't have a logical discussion with these people because they already believe they know. They don't come from a humble heart. They're not trying to serve you. They're not trying to help you. They just want you to believe what they believe. And you know, mea culpa, you know, like you see a lot in some churches, I won't name them, where somebody yells out a phrase and everybody repeats it. And so they want you to repeat after them. Now, James Webb said, Gregory Williams, I guess you don't know the parable of Jesus with the loaves and the fishes. He got his disciples to go into the crowd, and he was preaching to collect 5 loaves and 2 fishes from them. That's not what actually happened. He didn't go into the crowd. He asked, who amongst us has any food? That's amongst those ministers, you know, his disciples. He had 70 people of the Sanhedrin, 12 apostles, probably all kinds of other ministers, because they were already setting up a social welfare system of righteousness with everybody who got the baptism of Jesus. This is now thousands and thousands of people are not going to the temple of Herod. They're not signing up with the synagogues of Herod that have signed up, and they're certainly not signing up with the temple of Rome that Herod also built. They're signing up with Jesus. They're the ten censors and thousands and thousands and thousands of people, including Samaritans, are now all saying, we're going to go with this guy. Because this is what Rome wanted everybody to do, to sign up with a social welfare system. Like the one that Rome was setting up. You know, Herod could have his, and they could have one in Corinth, and they could have... And when they all will be like corporate religions under the umbrella of Ephesus. Because Ephesus was the World Bank. And so all the systems of religion from at least 127 different countries were tied to the Temple of Ephesus, so that when they sent up their heave offering, it went to the Temple of Ephesus. That was their premium, their insurance premium, for the insurance of the Temple of Ephesus and the protection, you know, if they had a shortfall, you know, like Vesuvius erupted or something. They would need all kinds of aid to help people out. And if they didn't have enough in their coffers, or if somebody robbed them or something, they had some insurance that was becoming from Ephesus. That's why 127 countries built it. That's why it had the most secure vault in all the Mediterranean. But your preachers don't tell you that. They just say that you have to believe in Jesus. You know, well, that's like telling all the people who got wounded and injured in the battle with the Amalekites, or Amalekites, that, you got a lot of injured, you got a lot of people with wounds, you got a lot of people lost a hand, an arm, a finger, a toe, a foot, a leg. You got a lot of husbands that died, there's a lot of widows, now there's orphans and everything. We're going to help you out. We're going to pile up stones and burn up sheep, and then you'll all be okay. How did we ever fall for such nonsense? Well, you go to all kinds of preachers and they say, no, that's what the Bible says. No, it's not. Because you're ignoring the metaphors of the language. And this is what we show you in our article on sophistry and our articles on altars of clay and stone. We show you the words and how they mean other things. Just like when Paul says, let every man remain subject to the higher authority, or higher power is what he says in the King James. And the other translator says that subject to government. But the word there that they translate government doesn't mean government. According to Aristotle, according to Paul, according to the Bible, according to poets 150 years later, after the Bible was written, they're still telling you. That word means liberty. You're still in the concordance. It's defined as the power to choose. You go tell somebody that has already accepted some false teaching on Romans 13. They don't want to hear it. They don't want to believe it. But it says, and Paul said it, that every man remains subject to the higher liberty, the original liberty. Because all liberty is of God, and there is no liberty but of God. And anyone who opposes liberty opposes God. That's what Paul's saying. Unquestionably. Read the book. Read your own concordance. But anyway, so he said, collected 5 loaves and 2 fishes from them, then distributed it all to them, and all 5,000 were fed with 12 baskets filled up with leftovers. That's what he says. He's wrong about them going out in the crowd and getting these fishes from one boy. It wasn't out in the crowd. It says 2 points from this. The first is that the act of generosity caused everyone to start sharing the food they had held back when the disciples were collecting it from them. Well, that isn't 100% accurate, but I haven't heard hardly anybody else say that the food that was shared by these people that had held back on sharing was where the food came from. Almost nobody says that. I haven't heard anybody preach it but me. This guy says it. Wow. That's James Webb. Where'd he get that? And anyway, the second is that this is a great example of socialism. Jesus was a socialist. Now that conclusion is just way off. I mean, this person probably doesn't know what fascism means. He certainly doesn't know what socialism means. I said, James Webb, first, they looked amongst the disciples for food to share with the people, not the whole crowd. You are right. The people started sharing because the disciples shared all they had and Jesus went hungry. They knew Jesus went hungry. We've explained this in great detail. This is exactly what Alexander the Great did to win the support and loyalty of his men. When somebody brought him water when everybody else was thirsty, he said, I will not drink till everybody drinks. And he poured out the water. Everybody doesn't do that. So, anyway, he was right. You are right about that. It says, we explain that in detail in Matthew 14 and 15. But none of that makes Jesus a socialist. I mean, why would that make him a socialist? It was free will offerings. The people chose to share because their king, their government, gave up everything he has. He was rich, according to Paul, and made himself poor. I mean, actually, Trump hasn't really done that, but he's done that closer than anybody else. I'm not advocating Trump again, so everybody cool your jets. I'm advocating Christ. But Trump's lost money because he's run for president. He's put his life at risk. They want to put him in jail for 100 years because they're scared to death of him. But if you think Trump can drain the swamp, I'm afraid he's going to get killed. I mean, that's an extreme possibility. Because Jesus got killed. Jesus did a lot more. But these are pretty ruthless guys you've been electing for the last 50 years. Some of these guys have been in office for 25, 30 years, and your people keep electing them. Why? Public school. Because you all decided public school is a good idea. Public school is a bad idea. Public school is a horrible idea. It makes the word of God in none effect. Social Security, horrible idea. It's the Corbin of the Pharisees. It's the Corbin of Caesar. And it will bring you into bondage, and it has brought you into bondage. Go read our article on employ. Go read our article on the bondage of Egypt. You're all back in the bondage of Egypt again. And you're back in the bondage of Egypt and numbered accordingly because you wanted benefits at the expense of others. And you had already developed an appetite for those benefits. And you had accepted the habit of living at the expense of others and having your children taught at the expense of your neighbor. So, well, I didn't take anything from my neighbor. Well, somebody did. But none of what we see happen there made Jesus a socialist. And so then I gave him the article, Was Jesus a Socialist? And I don't think I heard from him again. okay, there was a statement by... Oh, Tom Wilson said... Laugh out loud. Well, tell me which gods the modern school system is raising kids to follow exactly. So this is another quote that he wants to know, which gods, because that was the thing that the original quote was saying, is that there was these, and so of course I wrote back, well, the gods many of history, who were the ruling judges of the governments of the world, were the ruling judges. Well, that's those gods of government. When Paul said there be gods many and lords many, the term gods is from theos, which means ruling judges. That's what it means. You're giving somebody else the power to decide what is good and evil for you, and used to address judges in courts of law. Even in Hebrew, the word Elohim is often translated gods, was used in reference to men that would determine certain things, make judgment about certain things for you, and who had the power to judge the people. Those terms could refer to judges in court, like the Supreme Court. Most people, including modern Christians, pray to the public gods, you know, of Sumer, of Nimrod, for their daily administration, for their daily bread, and for their social protection. Have chosen for themselves, the public gods, they have chosen for themselves. But there is a price to pay, which is your liberty. The Greek and Hebrew words commonly translated gods all mean ruling judges who tells you what is good and evil. What gives men the power of these gods many to be ruling judges over the people? We teach this and much more with details and facts to back up everything, all for free. So he goes on to say, that's exactly the kind of warped answer I was expecting. How much time do you spend in school exactly? Have you seen this socialist force with your eyes? Or is this just a narrative you're happy to accept? See, he's accepted a narrative that socialism is not force. And you wonder, like, how in the world are you redistributing wealth? What socialist nation does not use force? He can't see it, but he hasn't identified things. He actually comes along eventually, a little bit, but he's still in a lot of denial. But again, this is why I talked about schizophrenics at the beginning. People have been traumatized. They see injustice and they want to find a solution. They grab at anything floating or seem to be floating. You know, like the guy who was hanging on to a shipwreck you know, his ship went down, there's wreckage there, and he grabbed the wreckage, and it was a little buoyant, and he was floating with this, like, wood and canvas and stuff like that. And finally, a boat came along. He'd been floating for a couple of days, and a boat came along, a rescue boat from another ship, and was trying to pull him up out of the water. And he would not let go of the wreckage to get into the dry boat. They had blankets there and guys and first aid guys, but he wouldn't let go of the wreckage. Because the wreckage was his salvation. And the trauma of the night in the dark sea clinging to wreckage made him, you know, what do they call it? The Stockholm Syndrome. For the wreckage! He was loyal to the wreckage. What on earth? But of course, that is absolutely reasonable. I cannot fault him for that. That is absolutely reasonable that he had come to that point. And, you know, I have to make allowances for that. And so I spent time trying to convince him, you know, or share more information with him. And he continued with me. He kept responding. That's exactly the kind of warped answer is his first comeback. I could have gotten all mad. Well, you don't know warped. You're the one who's warped. You know, that's the kind of... But if you actually care, that's not the answer that you want to give. So I'm trying to train you up a little bit so you can see where you can get into the... So he wants to know where this socialist force is. What do you think was warped? So I just ask him questions. Identify. First rule of logic. I never went to public school, but only private schools. But of course, that is irrelevant. Public education is socialist. That's true. It is. Maybe he doesn't get it that public education is socialist and funded by property tax, which is collected by men who exercise authority. I mean, if you had a property tax and it was voluntary, you know, I'd go down and pay it. I may not pay the full amount, but whatever I pay, if I'm in the kingdom, they have to say pay in full. That we have a thing out here. We have the RPA, which is a rural fire department, and one of my sons helped start it. And it's one of the biggest on the west side of the United States, I think. It might be one of the biggest in the United States. And it has all kinds of equipment now. It got a cat recently from that was donated to it. I mean, a big cat. I mean, like, it's got a 16-foot blade on it. So that's a big cat. And they got permission to haul it here. And the cops all helped them haul it. You know, all the way. It came up from Nevada. But they have put out so many fires. And it's voluntary donations. Well, they put out a fire that was threatening a big ranch, a multi-million dollar ranch. And they, after they saved the ranch, put out the fire, the ranch still just paid their $200 a year dues. Yeah, we have a few acres here. My sons and some of my family own it. I don't own the acreage right here. But we pay that much into the rural fire department and volunteer. And here, the multimillionaire guy just gave the $200. I was talking to one of the head guys just yesterday. And he says, you know, most of the ranchers, the big ranches, they give way more. They give thousands of dollars, you know, to help support it. Because they got a lot more than, you know, somebody with 100 acres. You know, somebody with just a, you know, a couple acres, he doesn't have to pay near. There's kind of a range of suggested prices. But you know, the one that sometimes the richest guys are the most selfish. And that's true. But you know why? Because all you people out there have not been seeking the kingdom of God and his righteousness. See, in Israel, the rich guy got to keep his wealth and riches because the poor weren't going to take it. The government wasn't going to take it. But foreigners might come and take it. And that rich man knows he's going to need all these other people round about him to help him keep his stuff. Because if the land gets overrun, he gets overrun. So he has to care about the rights of the little guy as much as his own, because there is no government-supported military. There's a militia. And if you want the militia to show up to protect your place, we had a guy who's fairly wealthy, had a real nice house, and he helped us fight a fire. And when the fire came to his place way up on the hill. And he had a sprinkler system and all this kind of stuff and battery pumps and everything to protect his house, you know. But the fire was hot. It was burning other things up on that hill and too much fuel around there. His deck was smoking. That's how hot the fire got. And the people of the community stayed there until they stopped that fire and saved his house. Now, the Forest Service and the cops down there on the highway, they were threatening to arrest the local citizens because they wouldn't evacuate. Said, we're not going to leave our neighbor's house to burn. We're going to stay there. I know other guys who went in, they had the volunteer fire department, had a machine to pump foam to protect houses that had brush coming right up to them. They should have cleared that brush away, but it came right up to the back of the house. It was so hot, it was breaking the windows. It was about ready to lose the whole house. And he ran in there with a truck and foamed it all and knocked the flame down enough to save the house. And they did it for each other. But that's because government doesn't care about this county. So we have to learn to care about one another. Well, if you go eat at the table of rulers, you're not going to care about your neighbors because you've got the table of rulers to eat at. You need to fast. You know, like it says in Proverbs, you sit and eat with a ruler and you be a man of appetite, put a knife to your throat. You're going to have to fast. And if you don't, what do you think? A powerful government is not going to bow to the will of the guy with the biggest bribe? You created offices of power and men of power will seek office. You will end up with rulers and kings and tyrants and despots. I mean, it's been repeated over and over again by philosopher after philosopher. But you don't study those philosophers in public school because somebody might catch on to the object of your bondage. Yeah, and he's still wondering. Socialist country does not use force? That's what I asked him. And I gave him the article, Exercise Authority, One Over the Other. It certainly does. And I don't know how anybody could miss it, but they do. So he responds back, Gregory Williams, oh, wow, so you honestly believe there should be no public education system. You really can't foresee any sort of issue that would cause. My friend, I don't know if it's the private education or your general environment, but you are incredibly out of touch to have that sort of opinion. I can tell you haven't been near public schools and you haven't done any sincere analysis of what goes on in them. From these brief statements, he's come to those conclusions. Why? Because it doesn't coincide with what he believes. So it must be wrong. That's not logic. Let's identify. But you know, that's the thing, is that people don't want to identify. They don't want to find out what somebody actually believes. They just don't want to do it. So I said, actually, I did answer your question. I may not have answered it the way you wanted. I also do not think you read the article I shared on schools as tools. I wrote it for another publication, but included more sources in the link on the page. There were two questions. So you honestly believe there should be no public educational system? And this is my statement back. That was this question in quotes. There should be no tax-funded public education. And one of the reasons I say this, there was all kinds of education open to the general public. It was often run by churches, but it was not necessarily religious education. They were going to hear about religion there, but they were going to learn to read and write and do math. And that was open to the public, but was funded by Christians. This was common. I also shared with him articles on Alexis Tocqueville so that he could see this. Jefferson, in a rare instance, with Bill 79, it's a Virginia bill, the General Diffusion of Knowledge was kind of the title of the bill. You can look it up. Even though he only wanted to use a tiny amount of existing funds in the state, you know, treasury, to jumpstart the project of building schools within walking distance in every district. That was his goal. It was rejected twice for several reasons. Madison pointed out that the cost was one of those reasons, although the money was already there. It wasn't like borrowing money against the future to provide for that. Jefferson was adamant about not borrowing funds at any time from the future to get anything done. Another reason was the suggestion to use property taxes were seen as an amoral practice, as an infringement on property rights, even though all land was not taxable at that time. When they talk about property tax is a use tax. If you own the land, really own the land. They couldn't put a property tax on it. If you merely had a legal title or a deed of trust or something like that, or an option to buy or whatever, lots of different ways, where it was an equitable title. When I say equitable, it's a title in equity. Legal title is a title in equity. Legal title does not include the equitable title. The equitable title is actually another one, but it's called a title in equity because somebody holds the equitable title, you hold the legal title. But the legal title, by definition, this is just right out of the law dictionary, you don't have to go to get fancy books or anything. Legal title does not include the beneficial interest, and the beneficial interest is the right to use the property. If you don't own the right to use the property, you're going to have to pay a use tax, property tax. That's just the law. And I've taken this to top lawyers in the United States, and they say, wow, you get it. They're not going to like you. That was one of the responses. And people want to know, well, how do I get the lawful title? Well, I'm telling you. I'm not going to tell you all the details. Because I don't know who's listening. It's not going to be easy. And it requires Christ on your side. And in order to have Christ on your side, you have to care about your neighbor as much as you care about yourself. You have to care about your neighbor's right. People who say, how do I get the title to my property? Right away. He's on the wrong side of the river. You know, he's trying to say, you know, he's going to head north. He's not going to follow Moses. I got my stuff. I'm going north. I'm not following Moses. Moses wants to go down that dry wadi. I'm not going that way. I'm going to go the regular route. I've never heard of them guys again. So, like I say, another was the suggestion of property tax, but most people thought that taxing your neighbor was amoral. They still thought that, although the idea was diminishing in the minds of the public because the people were moving into darkness. But still at the time of Davy Crockett. That's why we have an article up on Davy Crockett. You're not supposed to use taxes to help out the poor. You can use taxes to secure the general welfare, but not provide individual welfare. Because then you're taking from one group of people to provide for the other. I don't think Wilson's got that figured out yet. He's getting close, but he just didn't make the final connection. So another was the suggestion that property taxes were, okay, I said that one. And they talk about at the time, I'm actually quoting somebody who says at the time, that was really an odd thing because most people would not want to have done that. You did find that in Massachusetts, and I talk about that. The third reason was the failure of the bill was that the people were already building those schools through volunteerism. Often, by what was called the militia. Yeah, the militia was building roads, schools, hospitals. They actually even built prisons. They did all these things. And depending on what part of the country in, they did a good job or a bad job. It would vary because people vary. But they understood that volunteerism was absolutely essential for a free society. Absolutely essential for a free society. And, you know, the idea that the other question was you really can't foresee any sort of issue that would cause that, you know, we did away with public education. Of course there would be issue, but there are also issues with political habit of forcing your neighbor to pay for what you want for free. That has an issue. It weakens the people. Our article about Alexis Tocqueville or Thomas Jefferson, or Polybius, because they're telling you over and over again, I could put Plutarch in here, or an article on legal charity, which legal charity degenerates society, and you don't even see it. They don't know. It just creeps in and degenerates society. It degenerates the masses of society, and the masses need to be free. But in order to be free, we know they have to be responsible, and if they're not going to be responsible, they're not going to be free. Like I say, you have to take your responsibilities back if you want your freedoms back. And covetous practices, coveting your neighbor's goods in order to get things that you want, is not taking your responsibilities back. It's certainly not taking them seriously. Most of the problems today come from that very degeneration of the people. America is not one of the most rapidly anti-communist countries. All 10 planks of the Communist Manifesto are law in the United States today. Now, he's going to eventually ask me, what are you talking about? How do you figure that? Well, I already got the article written. Of course, they have to read it, but of course, we have a lot of people in this group who say, I'm not reading anything. There are no facts there. It's just opinions. No, there's facts there. But you have to want to see them. If you live in darkness, you're going to read it and say, well, there's no facts there. Because you're not going to see the facts. You're not going to believe that they're there. And I go on to quote Patrick Henry. Patrick Henry said, And these articles have expanded, so there's lots and lots of little pieces in there. And, you know, I'd recommend that people read them over and over again a lot of times, but, of course, I recommend that you follow the Holy Spirit. But he says we are apt to shut our eyes against the painful truth, and that's what these people are all doing. They're shutting their eyes to the painful truth. Socialism is a covetous practice. Capitalism restores the worker to the ownership of the means of production, which is mostly his labor. And listen to the song of that siren, till she transforms us into beasts. Perfect savages. Isn't that what Plutarch said? Polybius said that. But ruin Rome, Plutarch said. Is this the part of wise men engaged in a great and arduous struggle for liberty? Are we disposed to be of the number of those who, having eyes, see not, having ears, hear not, the things which so clearly concern their temporal salvation? For my part, whatever anguish of spirit it may cost, I'm willing to know the whole truth, to know the worst, and to provide for it. And of course, that's what we're trying to get you to do. Form our congregations of tens, hundreds of thousands, start giving. We would start building if we had more support and start taking care. I talked to, like I said, old couple. They're going to need help. They're going to need help. And we've done this before, but we've had to do it on our own. We have the land now. We just need the facilities. And, you know, we could start. We could probably start sometime this summer or certainly before fall. But you have to count the costs. You don't want to start and then leave off. So we're looking for congregations that really care, not just about what they need in their local community, but other communities. And really, that's what I started with to begin with. I haven't focused on my own community except where people needed help. And of course, I've been blessed greatly by the community because people saw me doing that. They still go to their false churches. They still listen to their preachers who think that the book contains the Word of God. No, the book talks about the Word of God. The Word of God is the logic of God. And the logic of God is that you cannot force your neighbors to contribute to what you want for free and expect not to go into bondage. Most children in America were home-taught until 1900s. Yet there was a high degree of literacy, which has declined. And so anyway, these are the things that I was writing Tom Wilson. He keeps coming back. He says, so what you're arguing for is a fully privatized education system, I suppose, complete with a financial burden that brings to the poor and with the inequality in education that would bring to reinforce a class tier society. Well, I've already explained that you won't have that class tier society if you do this same principle of the kingdom in every aspect. Fire, law enforcement, everything. You either take charge of your community or you don't. Well, of course, most of your community isn't going to agree. Most of your community isn't going to go along with it, especially if you have a highly populated community. But you can do an awful lot if you start doing it in small groups. And because people are going to have to see it happening. They don't believe. They don't believe by hearing. They have to see. They need signs and wonders. I get it. Well, they're not the real faithful, but they could start being supportive to the faithful. They need help with their unbelief. And, of course, that's why Christ was doing a miracle. And the greatest miracle of the loaves and fishes that the people started to share. That was absolutely essential. And, of course, the next guys he talked to about that, he says, you're just coming for the bread. It's the people that come to share what they have already. Cast their bread upon the waters. Those who will have abundance. Those who come just try to start an organization where we get real strong and we make preparations for our little community and we're trying to save ourselves in the little community. I'm trying to get a little team together here, save our little community. Not the way to go. Sorry, not the way to go. It's not seeking the kingdom. That's just seeking your own little kingdom. America was supposed to be the government of the people, for the people, and by the people. Then the people need to take their responsibilities back. Like before the Gettysburg Address, which is where they say that. If you want a free country, you need to establish the social bonds. And I have a social welfare through the power of the state always erodes liberty. For hundreds of years, we built schools and educated our children, cared for the aged and the infirm with basically no tax dollars. How did we do that? And it was actually shunned the idea of doing it. We had college education you could take with no student loans. And it wasn't like one person, somebody suggested. Yeah, one person, one token person they do this for. No, thousands. Thousands of people got college educations without paying any sizable tuition because the alumni paid it. Sponsors paid it. My own grandfather was born in the 1800s but died in the 1900s. Died, I think, around the time I was born, I think it was. It was actually my great-grandfather. He put numerous children through college at his own expense. He started farming in South Dakota with oxen and then with mules and retired in his 50s and then sent kids. He looked for kids that were hardworking, industrious kids. That's what you want to do is because what will happen is not only do the kids who need the most help and can take the best advantage of it will be helped, but the kids who are a little bit slothful and rebellious will see, well, wait a minute, they're helping those guys. Why are they helping those guys? Well, because those guys did their homework. They took the time to do the work. They help with their parents. They take care of their parents. They have virtue. So you reward virtue. You don't reward sloth. Like I say, being poor is not a virtue. It's an event. And then we have to ask, how come you're poor? Because we don't want to do anything to contribute to your poverty. Because your poverty may come from the poorness of your own spirit. From your own sloth and wantonness and avarice. We don't want to encourage that. We want to encourage responsibility. So we have to be discretionary in our charity. You say, well, that's not fair. He's poor. You need to help him out. You need not to be prejudiced. I'm not prejudiced. I know that it isn't helpful to buy booze for an alcoholic. Now you think, well, that's obvious. Well, we said in a couple programs ago, I mean, it was announced on the news that California is now buying alcohol for the homeless because that's what they want. So we got to buy them alcohol with your tax dollars. What? Now we have given that job to the public institution to decide how to care for one another, and they're not very good at it. Surprise, surprise, including the oversight of it. And so we have billions and billions of dollars that are squandered, wander off to who knows where. A lot of the COVID relief went overseas. Didn't go to Americans. It was designed to go to Americans, but other companies came in. Who do you think's funding all... You think it's a bad deal that all these illegal aliens are coming in and they're getting, like, government debit cards funded to $2,200 a month? You think, oh, look at that waste of that money. What do you think the guys who are handing out those cards are getting paid? I can tell you. Some of them are getting over $200,000 a year. Some of them are getting over $5,000 a month to hand out your money as fast as possible. And you're sitting there and saying, well, we're going to get Trump elected and that will save us. No, the ship's going down. You're not going to save the ship. It's going down. How soon? I don't know. But it's going down. It's rotten to the core. It's like those old wineskins that Jesus mentioned. You need to think differently, completely differently. We can look at education, I say, food, health, of the people, banking and the economy and disaster lurks around every corner. My intention is not to create a void, but seek the people willing to implement the alternative, which is what? The kingdom of God. But again, that requires the people to be willing to know the whole truth, to know the worst, and to provide for it. And so then I gave them the link to the Communist Manifesto page to show you how all 10 planks of the Communist Manifesto are law in the United States today. And I wrote that years ago. It's not a new thing. I mean, I used to sit down. I sat down to Thanksgiving dinner with Herb Feldberg. He was the FBI agent who was the guy who led Three Lives. You know, the old series, I Led Three Lives, the book, I Led Three Lives. And Dr. Schwartz, who wrote the book, Communists Can Be Communist. Now, I didn't follow their ideology, but it was very interesting, the things that you heard. You know, and I'd watched the program for years, and then I got to have Thanksgiving dinner with him. Fascinating man. Courageous man. Gutsy guy. But anyway, Tom Wilson says, what did Jesus say about the rich man getting to heaven again? And I wrote back to Tom Wilson, I will include your question about what did Jesus say about the rich man getting into heaven again. The one person said that you can't get into heaven if you're rich. Well, no, that's not what it says. It says it's harder for a rich man to get into the kingdom of heaven than a camel to go through the eye of the needle. And in order to get, and I've said this, I disagree with Barbara Therrien on this point, and she can disagree with me, that's fine. Although I don't think she's off too far on her logic, but she has some misinterpretations, but she does a wealth of archaeological work with the Dead Sea Scrolls, so I do quote her from time to time. But the Eye of the Needle was a small door that you often find in houses and villages. Sometimes you couldn't even get into the house without climbing up a ladder. The door wasn't on the main floor. You had to climb up on the roof, and then you entered through the roof. And this was so that people couldn't just charge in. This was why they learned pole vaulting. So they could run up to a house and pole vault onto the roof or over the wall and get in and attack. Well, not everybody had the sense of the knowledge or the expertise to do that, so you cut down on the number of people you had to be concerned about. But they had a little door that if guys were delayed and they got to this oasis or whatever it was, and they wanted to bring their camels and their goods inside the walls to protect them so that they'd get at least a few hours of good sleep before dawn. And see, once it was dark, they shut the doors, the big doors, so you couldn't come in through the big doors. But you could come through this little side door, which some people refer to as the Eye of the Needle, because it was hard to get through. One man could go through kind of sideways in some instances. And maybe they could widen it somehow a little bit for a camel, but the camel had to get down on the knees. Like that leper at the beginning of Mark. Or not, it wasn't at the beginning, towards the end of Mark. In the first chapter of Mark. Who got down on his knees. He already had everything stripped away. He was already a leper. But the rich man's going to have to take all the stuff off of his camel for his camel to get down on his knees. And he'll have to bring that in and put it in the, you know, inside the building. But he has to strip that camel. That we're talking about the camel. Or the analogy, identify the analogy. It's the camel we're trying to get in. The camel has to take all his riches off and be stripped of all his riches and get down on knees. And it still may have to be whipped a little bit to get it in there, but you can still get it in. And, of course, so the rich man, early on in the teachings of Moses, knows that I'm wealthy. You know, the one rich man who came to Jesus, I already give half of everything I have to the poor. That's a rich man doing 50% income tax. He's helping the poor at every opportunity. And he says, that's good. That's good. And, of course, now he's rich, but he's also employing all kinds of people, feeding all kinds of families, and giving all of his excess profits away. And maybe expanding, maybe getting richer, but sharing all the time. But then Jesus, he says, I want to do more. He says, okay, you want to do more. Give it all away. Come follow me. This is what all things in common. In order to be a minister of Christ, you had to give all your property away. And you had no property in your personal name. Everything has to be given away to others. You can't live like a rich man. You'll probably live like a poor man. But you sacrifice for others. Now, we don't want your family starving. That your inheritance is now that which people give. It's not, you know, we support ourselves almost entirely on manual labor, even at my age. It isn't just public school. It's everything. Anyway, he came back. I actually agree with you on all that. And actually, many socialists would agree with you on all that. I think he's delusional on that. What you're talking about is actually the end goal of communism, which is not the end goal of communism. It's what they espouse, but it's not the end goal of communism. Let me assure you, it's not the end goal of communists. I know, we just had a recording from the Communist Party in the Soviet Union. Their end goal has nothing to do with truth and caring for other people. It's about power. Socialism is about power. It's the power to take away from those people you think have too much. And you want to be the Robin Hood who gives to those people who don't have enough by stealing from others. Well, for one thing, that's not what Robin Hood was doing. And for the second thing, that's not what you should be doing. You're supposed to take what you have and share with others. That's what you're supposed to do. And I don't believe that all socialists would agree with me. But until then, peace on your house, and may God be with you. God bless.
You have been listening to The Keys of the Kingdom with Brother Gregory of His Holy Church. For more information on the educational ministry provided by His Holy Church and Brother Gregory, including services, counseling, lectures, books, and other audio materials, please write to His Church at Summer Lake, Box 10, Summer Lake, Oregon, 97640. You can also find us on the web at www.hisholychurch.net.